My name's Jeff St. Clair. I am host of All Things Considered on WKSU, our local NPR station, and a reporter here at WKSU. Thanks. Right now, I would like you to turn your cell phones on. All right? Because if you have a question for Bob Woodward, the way we're doing it tonight is that you go to Twitter. You know, if you have a Twitter app, then you go to KSU Ceremonies, and you put your question for later this evening. And I'm asking you to do that right now because it doesn't matter if you don't pay attention to me. You know, you can be on your phone. But when Dr. Warren and Bob Woodward are speaking, I want, you know, you put your phone away. I heard a story on NPR the other day. It was about Judge Damon Keith, who died on Thursday at the age of 96. He was, in 1967, the first African-American named to the federal bench, and he worked up until the day he died on Thursday. He's best known for his phrase, "Democracy dies behind closed doors." He's also known, that's for Judge Keith. He's known for taking on President Nixon in what is known as the Keith case, where he ruled the government does not have the right to spy on private citizens without a warrant. And in doing so, the Nixon administration had violated the Fourth Amendment. The Supreme Court upheld Keith's ruling in a unanimous decision that came down on June 19th, 1972. That's a very interesting date because it was 2 days after five burglars were arrested trying to bug the Democratic National Committee headquarters in Watergate in Washington. And that same day, a young reporter, only 9 months on the job at the Washington Post, was assigned to go down to the courthouse and find out who those guys were. Bob Woodward found that one of the burglars was a former CIA agent. They carried thousands of dollars in sequentially numbered $100 bills. Woodward and fellow reporter Carl Bernstein found they had been paid by the committee to reelect the president, and that Nixon's chief of staff was involved, and eventually that Nixon himself ordered a cover-up. The rest, as they say, is history. But this nation's history would have been very different if it hadn't been for the work of Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. Watergate, as it turned out, was the tip of the iceberg and the dirty tricks pulled by the Nixon administration. Democracy does die behind closed doors. The framers of the Constitution knew this. That's why the free press is enshrined in the First Amendment. You think about it. Think about what you know that's happening right now in the world. Think about what's happening in other countries right now, in Venezuela, Syria, Mozambique. What's happening in Washington? What's happening here in Ohio, in Akron, Cleveland, Columbus, in your hometown? I would venture to say that pretty much everything you know about what's happening is because a journalist reported it. A journalist. Went to the city council meeting. A journalist tracked down that affidavit. A journalist stepped inside that closed door to report on what happened. A journalist doing his or her job is what keeps democracy functioning. And I'm not going to ask you to think about that when our next fund drive comes around and you can call 330-672. No, I almost slipped into fund drive mode. Okay. It's worth noting that journalism schools across America saw their highest enrollment ever in 1974, students inspired by the work of our guest tonight, Bob Woodward. He continues to inspire journalists today. And I, for one, am very inspired by him and also very grateful that our president, Dr. Warren, invited him to be here tonight. And I was the first reporter that had a chance to meet Bev Warren when she was named Kent State president 5 years ago. And I am definitely not the first person to say how sorry we are to see her go. Bev Warren has defined courage for this campus. She has provided steady leadership, foresight, and been an inspiration for students, faculty, and staff for these past 5 years. For a campus that has seen its share of sorrow, Bev Warren, even so many years after May 4th, has embodied the healing that this community still needs. We all aspire to be Bev strong. Kent State University is a better place thanks to her vision and commitment to her adopted home here in Ohio. We all wish her the best of luck and fond wishes for a happy and fulfilling journey after her all too soon retirement in July. Please join me in welcoming Kent State President Dr. Beverly Warren.
Surprises never stop around here. Thank you so much, Jeff. And welcome everyone to our 2019 Presidential Speaker Series. What a deeply moving 2 days we have had here on our campus as we have recalled the events that solidified Kent State's place in American history. This day will also be about remembrance for us. As we approach the 50th anniversary of May 4th, I am proud and pleased that this university has now taken ownership of this legacy and will ensure that this commemoration is a lasting one and one where we will always remember, we will never forget. You know, May 4th has come to be about rededicating ourselves to the values of free speech, freedom of assembly, and freedom of expression. So I can think of no better day to host our Presidential Speaker Series than on this powerful moment, on this powerful day. This series began in 2012 with the idea of bringing world-renowned experts to the university for serious, thought-provoking discussions about a wide range of topics. This series allowed Kent State a forum for sharing and learning from some of the brightest, most enlightened, most stimulating minds of our time. In the past, this series has featured conversations with Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, filmmaker Ken Burns, and last year, journalist Dan Rather. Tonight's speaker is no exception to that high-impact group. Our speaker this evening, as you well know, is Mr. Bob Woodward, associate editor of the Washington Post, where he's worked since 1971. He has shared in two Pulitzer Prizes, first in 1973 for coverage of the Watergate scandal with Carl Bernstein, and second in 2003 as the lead reporter for the coverage of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Mr. Woodward has authored 19 books, all of which have been national nonfiction bestsellers. 13 of those have become number one bestsellers, more than any contemporary author. Jill Abramson, the former editor of the New York Times, once stated, "Woodward is truth's gold standard." Robert Gates, former director of the CIA and Secretary of Defense, said of Mr. Woodward, "He has an extraordinary ability to get otherwise responsible adults to spill their guts to him. His ability to get people to talk about stuff they shouldn't be talking about is just extraordinary and may be unique. No one digs deeper or has provided a more detailed or penetrating portrait of the nine presidents from Nixon to Trump. He has written about in these areas for the Post or in books." Bob Schieffer of the CBS News has said, "Woodward has established himself as the best reporter of our time. He may be the best reporter of all time." In listing the all-time 100 best nonfiction books, Time magazine called All the President's Men by Bernstein and Woodward perhaps the most influential piece of journalism in history. The film adaptation of the book featured Robert Redford in the starring role as our guest speaker, and I would say a magnificent likeness. Please join me in welcoming legendary journalist, Mr. Bob Woodward.
Thanks. Thanks. Thank you. You have no idea how many women I've disappointed. This is going to be a serious discussion this evening because we are living in serious times, and the matters I'm going to try to address are among the most serious in our history. I'm often asked, what do I worry about the most? And my answer is secret government. With enormous concentrations of power, particularly in the presidency, citizens and we in the media need to know more, not less, about what goes on in the government. In as aggressive a posture as possible to excavate the truth. The problem is that we rarely get the full story and learn time and time again that there is a missing piece or missing pieces. So I have discovered in looking at the Kent State shootings here in 1970, when four students were shot dead and nine others wounded. This occurred in 13 seconds when National Guardsmen fired 61 shots. Bear with me, if you will. First the history and then the new discovery. On April 30th, 1970, 4 days before the shootings, President Nixon announced the invasion of Cambodia. The expansion of the war triggered massive protests, especially in college campuses. Nixon publicly called the violent protesters bums. Here at Kent State, the Army ROTC building was burned down, and as you know, the Ohio governor called in the National Guard. According to Nixon's memoir, his chief of staff at the time, H.R. Haldeman, came to the president's office on May 4th to go over the schedule. But Haldeman reported the following, according to Nixon, quote, "Something just came over the wires about a demonstration at Kent State. The National Guard opened fire and some students were shot." Nixon asked, "Are they dead?" Haldeman said, "I'm afraid so. No one knows why it happened." Nixon writes in his memoir that he was stunned when the newspaper, and quote, "When the newspaper ran pictures of the next day, he wrote, I could not get the photographs out of my mind. I could not help thinking about the families suddenly receiving news that their children were dead because they had been shot in a campus demonstration. I wrote personal letters to each of the parents, even though I knew the words could not help. Those few days after Kent State were among the darkest of my presidency. I felt utterly dejected when I read that the father of one of the dead girls had told a reporter, my child was not a bomb. Nixon continued, the daily news reports conveyed a sense of turmoil bordering on insurrection. Haldeman wrote in his own personal diary that Nixon was very disturbed by Kent State. Nixon was, according to Haldeman, quote, afraid his decision in Cambodia had set it off. He issued a condolence statement, then kept Haldeman for the rest of the day seeking more facts, hoping rioters had provoked the shooting, that there was real evidence. He hoped that that had happened, but there was none. Nixon's public statement read by his press secretary, however, was devoid of any condolences or comfort. Nixon dictated, quote, this should remind us all once again that when dissent turns to violence, it invites tragedy. It is my hope this tragic and unfortunate incident will strengthen the determination of the nation's campuses, administrators, faculty, and students alike to stand firmly for the right which exists in this country of peaceful demonstration and dissent, and just as strongly against the resort to violence as a means of such expression. In his memoir, Henry Kissinger, Nixon's national security advisor, called the statement one of extraordinary insensitivity. My former assistant, David Greenberg, in his book, Nixon's Shadow, wrote that Nixon's callous reply sent activists to new heights of outrage. Anti-war literature railed against the immoral killings and destructions wrought by Nixon and the military establishment. On May 6, 2 days after the shootings, Nixon's Secretary of Interior sent Nixon a letter that was leaked. The letter urged that, quote, youth in its protest must be heard. Nixon was enraged and angry that the letter had been leaked. On May 8th, following days of public rage and unrest, can't imagine the turmoil that this stirred in our country. So Nixon decided to hold a press conference at 10 p.m. in the evening to field questions about Kent State in Cambodia. Asked about what he thought the students were trying to say, Nixon said, quote, they are trying to say they want peace. They are trying to say they want to stop the killing. They are trying to say that they want to end the draft. They are trying to say we ought to get out of Vietnam. I agree with everything they are trying to accomplish. I think I understand what they want. I hope they would understand somewhat what I want. Later in the press conference, he mentioned what he called the rule that I have always had, and it is a very simple one. When the action is hot, keep the rhetoric cool. He then spent 5 hours in a telephone marathon making 51 calls to friends and relatives. He's deeply unsettled. At 4:40 a.m. that night, unable to sleep, he took an impromptu trip to the Lincoln Memorial to talk to protesting students to lay out his argument that he was really seeking peace. After this early morning sojourn, Henry Kissinger and Daniel Patrick Moynihan, another Nixon aide, both thought that Nixon was, quote, according to the memoirs, on the edge of a nervous breakdown. Kissinger wrote in his memoir, "The president saw himself as the firm rock in this rushing stream, but the turmoil had its effect on him as well. His awkward visit to the Lincoln Memorial was only the tip of the psychological iceberg. Demonstrations and violence continued through the country. 440 colleges, just imagine that, closed down or were disrupted. This is the record. But Nixon, of course, had a secret tape recording system that captured what he said for thousands of hours and what he really meant. What did Nixon really think, this master of concealment? What did history miss? Fast forward to 18 months from the shootings here at Kent State. It's the fall of 1971, when more than 1,280 prisoners at Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York rioted, took over the prison, and held 42 staff members hostage. It was an unheard of prison revolt. After 4 days, on the morning of September 13th, state police took back the prison, initially killing 29 inmates and 9 hostages. That afternoon, Nixon met in the Oval Office with Haldeman, his chief of staff, from 4:36 to 6:40 for one of their endless talks. Disclosed here for the first time really is more of Kissinger's psychological iceberg. And according to the tape, I asked an expert at the University of Virginia to just see if there was anything in the tapes about Kent State that was not known. His name is Ken Hughes, probably the most knowledgeable and devoted scholar on the Nixon tapes. So he searched and he said, "My God, I found something completely new. I didn't even know it existed." So in this meeting between Haldeman and Nixon, it begins with Haldeman saying, "There's no intelligence of any further black uprising at Attica." Nixon, "You know what I think? This might have one hell of a salutary effect. You know what stops them? Kill a few." "Sure," Haldeman said. "Nixon, remember Kent State? Didn't it have a hell of effect, the Kent State thing?" "It sure did," Haldeman said, gave them second thoughts. Once again, the secret tapes, which eventually ended the Nixon presidency, disclosed that Nixon, who he really was and what he had become. "You know what stops them? Kill a few." "Kill a few" is one of the most chilling and frightening remarks made ever by an American president in the Oval Office. It should, and I suspect will, go down in the lexicon of Nixon's most outrageous statements. Well known: blow the safe, break in, lie and stonewall the grand jury. "I am not a crook." So we now know what really was on Nixon's mind as he reflected back on Kent State 17 months after those shootings, that there was something salutary about kill a few. After Kent State, Nixon established the President's Commission on Campus Unrest, Months later, the commission released its report saying firing into a crowd of students was, quote, unnecessary, unwarranted, and inexcusable. The report also said this crisis has roots in divisions of American society as deep as any we have seen since the Civil War. The divisions are reflected in violent acts and harsh rhetoric. Kent State and the protest movement, it turns out, was an incubator for Richard Nixon and his illegal wars. The seeds of destruction were planted, not of those who would protest, but the seed of the destruction of Nixon himself. A month after Kent State, Nixon began in earnest a series of secret wars against those who opposed the Vietnam War. He initially approved a top secret plan called the Houston Plan to expand wiretapping, intercepting mail, and breaking into the homes and apartments of anti-war activists. This was followed by Nixon's next war, the war on the news media, 17 wiretaps of reporters or White House aides, the creation of a unit called the Plumbers to track down news leaks. They broke into the psychiatrist's office of Daniel Ellsberg, who had leaked the Pentagon papers, to get dirt on Daniel Ellsberg. Imagine breaking into a psychiatrist's office to get dirt on a political opponent. After that was Nixon's war against the Democrats. This was the Watergate burglary and the well-funded campaign of espionage and sabotage. Next was Nixon's war on justice. That is the Watergate cover-up. And finally, conducted after resigning in 74, a war on history, trying to convince the world that Watergate was really insignificant. The day Nixon resigned, August 9th, 1974, he gave a farewell address in the East Room of the White House. And he stood there, he had no script, he was sweating. His wife, two daughters were standing behind him, his two son-in-laws, and he talked about his mother and his father, and it was kind of another one of the opening of what Henry Kissinger called the psychological iceberg. And Nixon said the following, it was an amazing moment. Here he had fought to become president all his life, and now he had to give it up. And he waved his hand and he said the following: always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them, and then you destroy yourself. I mean, what an amazing discovery that the hate was the poison that brought him down. Now, 49 years after Kent State, we have these great divisions in our society again. And we have a new president, Donald Trump, who exploits in public the divisions without restraint. The Trump rallies, if you've seen them on television or attended, are really it is almost a primal amphitheater for Trump to just expound on what comes into his mind at the moment. Some excerpts, quote, from Donald Trump: knock the crap out of him, would you? I promise you, I will pay your legal fees. I'll beat the crap out of you. I'd like to punch him in the face. Maybe should have been roughed up. Part of the problem is that no one wants to hurt each other anymore, from the President of the United States. Trump also said, "I don't know if I'll do the fighting myself or whether other people will." The response to all of this by the president's press secretary, Sarah Sanders, quote, "The president in no way, form, or fashion has ever promoted or encouraged violence." This is the road to Watergate, and we have at this moment in history a president who has really launched the legitimization of hate. Now it's legitimate. It's okay to talk about punching people in the face and fighting. When I undertook the book on Trump Fear, Trump in the White House, I had a number of paths I could take, and I decided to focus on what he did as president, and I just want to give one example. At a National Security Council meeting that was top secret, this is 1 year into the Trump presidency. President Trump is railing against all the money the United States is spending on organizations, military alliances like NATO. He said, we are fools. We are suckers. We could be so rich if we weren't so stupid to spend this money. Goes on and on. And finally, then Secretary of Defense James Mattis, the retired four-star Marine general, can take no more of this, and he says to Trump, "Mr. President, we are doing these things to avoid World War III." When I first heard that, I had a chill that pretty much, I think you can argue, and I think history shows, I know my reporting shows, that job one for a president of the United States is to prevent World War III, that he had to be told by his defense secretary that that's why we were doing all of this, is one of the most frightening examples of what I call a governing crisis. And that's the crisis we have. And I think we can learn from the history of Nixon and this this shocking response to the killings here at Kent State. When I heard that, and Nixon said, "You know what I think? Kill a few." That's the way we were going to deal with this. So there's no ending to this story other than we better wake up to the fact that the era of the Vietnam War and the hostility and the poison of the Nixon era is not over, but I fear has been reincarnated in our government today. Thank you very much.
We have some questions. Some people took us up on our Twitter question solicitation. Thank you, Bob.
Did Trump ask a question?
You know, it's funny. I don't. That's a good one. You know, it's. He is known for tweeting. Yeah.
He is, yes.
I haven't seen any hashtags.
Before my book came out a month, he called me up. And with his permission, I recorded it, and he said, why didn't we talk for the book? You've always treated me fairly. And I said, well, I tried, and I listed the people, and he just said, you know, he didn't understand that at all. And so the book came out. He has changed his mind about whether I treat him fairly, by the way.
Well, it's an interesting book. I think we're going to talk a little bit about the parallels. This is one of the questions I wanted to start with, and this is something the students mentioned today when you met with the students about how polarized it is today compared to 1970, and your assessment of that. And this is one of the questions from the audience. Can you talk about the parallels between the culture of the 70s and our current cultural climate? And I suppose in starting with the polarization and then anything else that's interesting to you.
Well, people are angry and people are distressed, and clearly lots of people feel left out, and that there is, and they're not happy with the news media. It's not, Trump has generated a lot of this, and we need to, in the news media, rather than be defensive about it, need to walk that painful road of introspection and realize we get too emotional, that there is an edge to lots of the reporting. I was telling the story, Catherine Graham, the publisher and owner of the Post, wrote Carl Bernstein and myself a letter after Nixon resigned, and she said, oh, you did some of the stories and now Nixon's gone. Don't start thinking too highly of yourselves. And said, let me give you some advice. And the advice is beware of the demon pomposity. And that is really good advice. We need to not be so sure. In the news media, we need to stick to the facts. We need to not get into this political food fight that is going on. And as Ben Bradley, the great editor of the Washington Post, said, as a reporter, you have three things to do. Keep your nose down, your ass in the air, and move slowly forward.
I'm gonna have to remember that.
Yeah.
I guess I just have to admit that I see why they did cast Robert Redford, you know, in the movie, but he did influence, just kind of off topic a little bit.
How unlike you.
I know, yes. But he influenced you a little bit and had some advice for you All the President's Men, right?
Yeah, and he said, write a book about the reporting that we did, because he found that interesting, Carl and I, so different, so out there alone. I mean, you can't imagine how lonely it was. No one would really, a few people, but not many, would pick up our stories. And then when the White House would denounce us, then that would be on the front page of lots of newspapers. So it was an uphill journey, and Redford realized that, and he said, let's focus on that. Mm-hmm.
Here's another question from the audience. Do you think the fake news phenomena has led to increased public distrust in the media?
The what?
The fake news phenomena.
What's the fake news phenomena?
Well,
it's Trump's label for what he doesn't like.
He has called...
Yeah.
It's very similar to what Nixon, I had a quote from him. He said, the press, don't forget the press is the enemy.
Yes.
He told Halderman that.
Yeah.
And Trump has said the same thing.
Yes. And it's the same strategy, make the conduct of the press the issue, not the conduct of the president. But, you know, we have to be answerable for what we do. We make mistakes. And at the same time, I am convinced from knowing so many reporters that the work is done by and large in good faith, and good faith is important, and I think when the president calls us fake news, that's not in good faith. I think if we had him here on sodium pentothal, the truth serum drug, it would take a lot of the drug.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean,
yeah.
By the gallon.
Right, yeah.
And, but if we were to get the truth, it's all tactical. Oh, the press, we are writing things that undermine what he's doing or reveal this chaos, this uncertainty. I have in the book some sections about Trump dealing with his lawyer last year, John Dowd. And Dowd, well-known criminal lawyer in Washington, became very close to Trump, worked with him endlessly on potential testimony that Trump would give to the Mueller special counsel investigation. And they did a practice. And so Dowd, the lawyer, pretended he was Mueller. And they're in the White House on a Saturday, and they're looking the Washington Monument and the Jefferson Monument. And he asks Trump a question, and Trump just makes up something, denies it. And finally, the lawyer says to Trump, you can't testify, because if you do, you'll wind up in an orange jumpsuit. Now, even in Ohio, they know what an orange jumpsuit is, right? and then finally, Trump says he's going to testify, and Dowd, his friend, supporter, and lawyer, says, I can't let this happen, and he resigns. And then in a conclusion about Trump, he doesn't want to insult Trump, but the last line of my book is Dowd concluding that Trump's problem is, quote, you're a fucking liar.
Do we bleep that?
Sorry.
Is there a bleeper here?
I apologize for that. But that's real life. And now, that's his lawyer. That's not Nancy Pelosi saying that. That's his lawyer saying. And if you look at this, you know, the idea that we can just kind of make up facts and say anything we want, deny anything, and you can't run a lemonade stand. You have to be able to have facts. One lemonade is 15 cents, and you know, and so, and Trump, my conclusion is that all the tweeting and bluster and all of the work he does is really a disguise. It's a disguise because he only cares about the show, the pyrotechnics of being president, and he really doesn't care about governing. And governing is really, that's the center. You know, presidents can do great things, and it's too bad the energy he has, and clearly the political talent, isn't. I always think, what's the job of the president? Job of the president, I think, is to establish the next stage of good for a majority of people in the country. Then, we could figure out what that is, and then develop a strategy and move toward it. And as best I can tell, in 2+ years of work on Trump, that never comes up. Mm-hmm. What's the next stage of good for a majority of people in the country? That is a sacred trust a president has, and it is being squandered.
You call it the dog that doesn't bark when you're listening to and looking at all the, in terms of Nixon too, is the same thing, that it was all about his distrust, his paranoia, his attacks on the Democratic Party during the election. It's never about what's good for the people. It's a parallel. I wanted to pick up on something that you had mentioned here, and I think was part of the reaction when we're examining the reaction to Nixon. And I think that I want to talk about the tape that you found, discuss that.
What do you think of that?
Well, it is chilling when you say when he says kill a few, especially here in Kent, growing up in Kent and always feeling that remorse and the sense of mourning that has lingered over this town for 50 years to have the president
not say just
that.
The town, but the country. Kent State, when I got the invitation, I mean, I thought, wow, you know, that's one of the markers in 20th century history, what happened. And then to see that Nixon is essentially saying, oh, you know, it will be salutary. It's going to be a good thing. Kill a few is, well, you know, that is, you know, the language doesn't work for how frightening it is, and that he would be so in his own mind, I've got to fight this war, and anyone who resists is an enemy, and, you know, let's kill a few. Well, there it is, out in the open. I was going to play the tape here, but it doesn't work in this big an auditorium, but
we
listened, and I heard it.
Yeah, beforehand. It's a little rough, but you can hear that part. I just want to get back to in terms of his reaction to the May 4th shooting, one of the first things he did was establish the Houston plan, which I hadn't heard of, and when reading, you know, you brought it up and looking more into it, the Houston plan mobilized the CIA, the FBI, the National Security Agency, armed forces, everybody to spy on private citizens in the anti-war movement.
Yes, and Nixon signed it. And the author informed him it was illegal. That didn't bother Nixon. He signed it. And then J. Edgar Hoover, then the FBI director, found out about it. He was very angry and protested because he felt wiretapping and break-ins, that's the FBI's job.
Yeah, right.
and looked at it as some sort of turf fight. And finally, Nixon rescinded the order. But then if you go through, he has said, oh, let's implement it anyway, and of course they did.
It did, yeah, it sort of resurfaced in the plumbers looking into the Democratic Party in the election of 1972,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and if you, it gets tedious, but what the full investigation showed that Nixon's, the Watergate plan of spying and espionage was designed to destroy the system of nominating presidential candidates. And they went after Senator Muskie, who was the leading contender, and they took it away from him by doing little things by big things. And Senator Irvin, who ran the Watergate investigation, asked a really good question, which is, why Watergate? Why did we have this? And we had it because of Nixon, but Senator Irvin's answer was, why Watergate? It was a lust for political power. It was a sense of entitlement to political power. And there is a parallel here. Donald Trump knows something about lust, and the lust for political power is manifest in some of his actions and this sense of, you know, I'm wonderful, everyone loves me, and if your teenager talked like that, you'd slap him down.
It presents a problem. It does. All right, let's get back to some of these questions here. What was it like working on Watergate so early in your career? I mean, it changed the course of history in this country, and it changed your personal history.
It was, we were protected by Katharine Graham, by the editors at the Washington Post, and they just said, you know, get more facts, check it out. And so it was just go. This is what we do. Katharine Graham once told me that. She said, why do you think we're doing this? And I said, I'm not sure. And she said, well, it's because the business we're in. And she was the one who said, because it's about Nixon, the president, we need to triple and quadruple our effort and not pull back. And she was willing to absorb all the risk.
There's other questions about the press today in terms of like the attacks on the press being called the enemy. How may we as private citizens support the free press? What role do we play in this back and forth?
Well, listen and be patient with us. It's not fun, believe me, to have the leader of the free world, you know, this enemy of the people, fake news, and so we've got to find a way to reestablish our credibility, and I think part of that.
We as journalists?
Yes,
and the media.
I think lots of people believe what we do, but not enough. And that a president can have a political strategy to paint us as the problem is quite astonishing. And I talk to business groups, and anywhere from, if you ask how many people distrust the press, and I think in lots of groups, it's almost required that you distrust the press, but you get 30%, 40%. I've once, I'm embarrassed to say, had 90% of the people raise their hand and say they distrust the press. So we can't kind of say it's their problem or Trump's problem. It's our problem. We have a product that we need to make better. If you're in a business and you know that you're making a storm window that leaks, that's your problem, not the people who complain about it. And even if you think you've got a pretty good product, you've got to make it much, much better. And the responsibility is with us.
We live in a different media world, though, than 1972, 24-hour news cycle. There's all these different platforms. Anyone could be a blogger and compete with competing ideas, I suppose, but without credibility.
That's the First Amendment, and I don't think we should wring our hands about that. I think it's out there. I think there are lots of people who just ignore it. My wife Elsa, at our house, we have a Trump-free hour. I'm not allowed to talk about Trump. Sometimes there's actually a Trump-free dinner. Can you imagine that? That's
a great
that's
idea.
That's long.
Yeah. I have to try that.
And so, you know, the if Trump heard that, you mean somebody's not talking about me? I mean, he loves the attention. In a very important way, but don't lose sight of, and that's, you know, you're right to say the impatience and speed of the internet, but last year there was a perfect poll, and the perfect poll was in November of last year. It was called the Congressional Elections for 435 seats, and it wasn't abstract. It wasn't robocalls on the phone. It was people who decided to go vote, right? And 10% of the seats shifted from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party, a phenomenon that we only saw after Nixon. And so that's a message. And It doesn't guarantee what's going to happen, but it is a forecast that people, are kind of saying, "Hey, what do we got here? Is this not just good for my business or the economy, but is this good for the country?" And so we'll see. And as Trump says, it's going to be very interesting to see who's going to run against Trump from the Democratic Party.
Do you have any favorites?
I have the name of the person here.
Oh, seriously?
Down on
Bob Woodward with another scoop.
I forgot to bring it. Oh. I'm sorry. but you can't tell. You can't tell 20 months before an election. If you look at the last four presidents, Clinton, George W. Bush, Obama, Trump, if we were sitting here 20 months before each of these elections.
I have no idea.
And Clinton, he wouldn't make the top 50, except in his own mind. But he was elected president. George Bush was elected. He'd been governor of Texas, and Obama was elected. He beat Hillary in the primaries. Trump was elected in 2016. We can't tell, but that'll be sorted out in the campaign. But I think the core of it is, from doing this for so many decades, a successful presidential campaign has to have a message that says, one way or another, I'm going to use the power of the presidency to fix X, Y, or Z for you. Clinton did that in 92. So I'm going to use the power of the presidency to fix the economy for you. Trump in 2016, it was Steve Bannon who was his chief strategist. I have this in fear that it was August 2016, Trump's down 14, 16 points in the polls, worried. And Bannon says, "Don't worry." And why? Trump says. And Bannon says, "Well, 2/3 of the people in the country think we're on the wrong track. 3/4 of the people think we're in decline. That's Hillary Clinton. You win." Now, that's too simple an explanation, but it's a pretty good explanation. People felt we're on the wrong track, or they're out of it, that the nation is in decline, and Trump came along and offered, we're going to have to look. One of my personal moments of introspection, we should have got Trump's tax returns in 2016. And published them.
You personally, like the Post?
Me personally. The lawyers said, there's a law against it. And, there is statute. You're going to go to jail if you get them, and we publish them.
Did you have a way of getting them somehow?
I didn't succeed.
Yeah.
It was a failing on my part. I didn't try hard enough. Now, the reason you want his tax returns is somebody in the IRS told me this, said, it is a roadmap to who he is. And he made this comparison. Suppose some senator's running for president, and you can't get their voting record. That'd be absurd, right? Mm-hmm. Trump's tax returns are his voting record. That's who he is. And we should have, and there's a great tradition of defiance in the news media, publishing the Pentagon Papers, all of the Watergate reporting was, I've reported on things where I've had CIA directors, put their hands in their face, say, you can't publish that, and you have to publish, and you have to be very aggressive. And I think when history is all put together, we're not going to like the fact that we didn't get his tax returns.
Well, they subpoenaed them. They're fighting the subpoena. See, it's going to go to the Supreme Court.
What we've lost sight of with Trump, he understands the power of no. And what are they going to do? Send the sergeant of arms from the Senate down to the White House to, you know, it isn't going to work. Trump controls the military. He's got the power. And you can go to the court. I was always surprised when the Supreme Court told Nixon to turn over the tapes. And it is very much to Nixon's credit that he said, okay, I'm going to comply. But he could have said...
Maybe they got somebody threw him away.
Sorry. Yeah they burned. Oops. You know, at one point, Nixon was so covetous about his tapes, he wanted to put them under his bed in the White House. You know, Dr. Freud, tell us what that really means.
And, well, it was about his legacy.
And the lawyer said, well, there's so many of them, they won't fit under your bed.
Raise the bed.
Yeah.
Well, that Nixon was so concerned about his legacy. That's why he installed the tapes to begin with. And that's why he wanted to rewrite history. That's his, the fifth war that you talk about.
Yes, right. Yeah, the war against history.
And we came so close of those tapes never being revealed. It was one guy who finally admitted that there were tapes.
Yeah, Alexander Butterfield. Who?
Otherwise, Nixon probably would have resisted, or he would not have been impeached. He would not have been forced to resign without the tapes.
Right. History. And so that's why, as a reporter, you need to go out and find new sources, new information, not try to relitigate the Mueller report and kind of say, well, on page, you know, 312, it says this, and, you know, that's potentially obstruction of justice. And, you know, Mueller decided he couldn't decide. And the attorney general, who's the charging authority, whether you like it or not, he is, and he said no. And so the Mueller report, it will surface, and it's important, but I think it's a phase, and I think we're going to go into the
phase. But the big phase.
Can I tell one somewhat long story? Or
I guess so. Let me check the time.
No, go ahead. Okay. Okay.
I haven't gotten any...
Okay. So, oh, no, come on. You know,
all right.
If people have to
long
leave,
story, everyone's
go ahead and leave. Because this is something that's stuck with me for a long time. And it has to do about not just what happened, but what it means. And we write about things and we don't sort through them fully about what they mean. And it was September 1974. Nixon had resigned the month before. Gerald Ford was president. And Ford went on television early on a Sunday morning announcing a pardon for Nixon for Watergate. And it was a shock. And Ford went on television early Sunday morning, I think he hoped everyone was in bed and wouldn't notice. But it was noticed, but not by me. I was asleep. And Carl Bernstein called me up and said, have you heard? And I said, I was asleep. And Carl, racing to his point, and he always and still has the ability to say what occurred with the most drama in the fewest words, said, the son of a bitch pardoned the son of a bitch. And I felt quite proud that I had decoded that so quickly. And I remember thinking that it's perfect. Nixon gets a pardon, he's the only one. Ford gets the presidency. And there was an aroma of a deal. And 2 years later, Ford ran against Carter and essentially lost because of the suspicions of the pardon. And that was kind of the way history was, and so I undertook one of my book projects, a book called Shadow, about the legacy of Watergate and the presidencies of Ford through Clinton. And I'd never interviewed Ford, never met him,
So this is 1998-99. Called him up, and he'd been out of the presidency for over 2 decades. I'd like to talk to you about the pardon. And I thought he would not want to, but again, this was a miscalculation on my part. Ford was the most open person I'd ever met. And they said, come on. And we did a series of interviews in New York where he would go to board meetings. He had a home in Colorado, main home in Rancho Mirage, California. And had 2 full-time assistants, luxury of time. What happened? Why did we have this pardon? And I kept going back to Ford with more questions. And it was the last interview in Rancho Mirage, California. And it was, he had a little bungalow there or in his office, tape recorder going for history. And why'd you pardon Nixon? And he smiled and he said, you keep asking that question. I said, because I don't think you've answered it. And to my astonishment, he said, you know, you're right. I've never told the full story. And out came this monologue about precisely what, and he said, I haven't even told Betty this. And he said, here's what happened. A week before Nixon resigned, Al Haig, Nixon's chief of staff, came to Ford, who was then vice president, and said, if you agree to pardon Nixon, he'll resign and you get the presidency. And I'm sitting there going, holy shit, there was a deal. And then Ford said, there was no deal. I knew that was corrupt. And he made a persuasive case, said, look, I knew Nixon was finished at this point. I was getting the presidency. You don't make a deal, give up something for something you know you're going to get anyway. And then he took me to, he said, let me tell you exactly what I thought and what I was experiencing. He said, I became president. I never wanted to be president. I wanted to be Speaker of the House. All of a sudden, I'm president. Nixon's gone. And every day, Nixon questions, what about what Kissinger's doing? Is so-and-so, are you changing the policy here? What about Nixon? Is he gonna, what about the tapes? And he said, I was haunted by the Nixon presidency, and I was supposed to have the Ford presidency. And I had to look at this situation in a way I'd never looked at a political situation before, and that is, not how do I get out of it politically, but what's best for the country? What's the national interest? I'm the president. And the economic trouble, the Cold War was still on. Jaworski, the special counsel, special prosecutor had sent a letter saying that Nixon is a citizen's going to be investigated because of the tapes, the damning. He certainly will be indicted, tried, probably go to jail. So Ford said, we're going to have 2 or 3 more years of Nixon and Watergate. Could not stand. He said in this plaintive voice, I needed my own presidency. I had to act not for myself, because I knew, pardoning Nixon, I was going to get slaughtered. I had to, yeah, for what's right. And so I talked to everyone and put it on, and in the book said what he did was gutsy. And Caroline Kennedy, the daughter of John F. Kennedy, called me up and said she had read in the book as her uncle, Senator Kennedy, had read. And said, we agree, and we're going to give Gerald Ford the Profiles in Courage Award that we give the Kennedy Library every year for somebody who does, some politician who does something in the national interest but kills, self-sabotages their own career. And so I did not go to the ceremony, but I watched it, and there's Teddy Kennedy saying, I called the pardon almost a criminal act at the time. I was wrong. This was, wow. This was in the national interest. And Ford sitting there kind of vindicated. I'm watching What a cold shower for me, because
written the book.
I hadn't written the book, but I was sure it was corrupt. I would have staked my life on it in 1974. And then you do the whole excavation and research and back to Ford and back to all these people in the memoirs and say, what really happened here? And I thought it was corrupt. And you go through that process 25 years later, and it's courage, the exact opposite. Now, you can't have that experience, which was humbling and, to be honest with you, humiliating. I was so wrong.
Wow.
So wrong. So we sit and we evaluate things, and always there's that little voice of, well, maybe it's the other way. And when Trump became president, I said to myself, this is a turning point in history. Stop doing television things for the Washington Post, and went back into Watergate mode, knocking on doors at night, talking to people, and say, I have to tell the story of what went on in the first 2 years of this man's presidency. I can't wait 25 years.
Yeah. Well, we have to wrap things up tonight.
Okay.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.
Three surprising things. I just want to summarize. Nixon's worse than we thought. Ford did the most honorable thing.
Is better than we thought.
And you just admitted you were wrong.
Yeah. And so I'm worse than
you. So that's where we leave everyone tonight. Thank
exactly
you so much.
Right. Good. Thank you. Thanks so much.
That was a pleasure. Thank you.